Hi everyone, I'm Alex. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I'd like to thank Mark for asking me to come out to speak. It's always an honor and privilege to come out here. And Roy, thank you. That was a dynamite lead. Guy drove almost 120 miles. That's going to any lengths. I like that. And you know, for the married couples in this room, you know, the boyfriends and girlfriends, if you don't have one and you got a dog, I think dogs are the best people. You can tell them anything and they won't open their mouth. And if you're single, I wish you all a very happy Valentine's Day. And, you know, before February 4th of 97, I knew nothing about love. Nothing. The only thing I knew was I was a taker, and love was not love, it was trade. Relationships were trade. I didn't have a clue what was going on in the world of love. And, you know, I have to rewind the way back clock, and I'm going to give you some background on my parents. My father was born July 6, 1920, and my mother was born February 16, 1930. Right away, you knew Pop liked them younger. And, you know, my mother was born in Chicago, Illinois, but she was raised in a little town in the mountains of Mexico called Jesus Maria. That's Jesus and Mary. And my father was born there. The difference was my mother's father, my grandfather's name was Jesus. He had businesses in that little town and in Chicago. And him and his partner were the first people to bring power to that little town. Later, the government took it away because you're not allowed to do stuff like that in Mexico. And my father's family were dirt poor. I mean, there was like six kids in the first brood with my dad, and his mother died when he was six. And he learned how to be a butcher at a very young age. And my grandfather would, you know, they would make carnitas and they'd butcher the meat and they'd sell the meat. They'd give the money to my dad's father and he would just take off and he'd leave the family to their own devices. He was kind of a jerk. And he was well known for being a jerk to that little town. And my mother came from the affluent side. They had, you know, servants. They lived in the big house by the main square. So as the years progressed, you know, my father came to the United States in 1942 during World War II. And at that time, they gave him a choice. Contract labor, pick lemons in Simi Valley, or join the army to fight the Japanese, and if you come back, we'll make you an American citizen. So my father thought it was a good idea to keep Simi Valley safe from Japanese invasion, and he picked lemons, and he worked really hard, and every year he would go back to that little hometown to party his little butt off with all the relatives. And over the time when my mother was of age, he had a crush on my mom. And I guess he was a bad boy because he eventually hooked up with her and her family would not go to the wedding. He had to have a, he owned a little house over there. He had to sell it to get the wedding. And when they came here, they wound up in East LA and I got two older sisters. And once they were born, her parents came down to see the children and they learned to accept my father. And he wound up getting a job at General Motors in Van Nuys in the plant. And he bought a little house in Pacoima. And they really wanted a boy. And they got me. And I was spoiled. I was spoiled rotten as a kid. I broke all my toys. And when I got older, I went to the school called Mary Immaculate. It was a Catholic school. And I was introduced to being a Catholic. And I didn't believe in that God. It was a punishing God. And when my sister graduated eighth grade, she went to St. Genevieve's. And I went there. At the same time, my mother was complaining the house was too small. So my father got a house in Arleta, which is the Beverly Hills of Pacoima. And when we got there, there was something different. I'm going to tell you a quick story. Bobby lived on the other side of the freeway, and he was the first Mexican on the block over there. But where I was, we were the first Mexicans on the block over here. And it was like Ireland, you know, freckles, blonde hair, German kids. And I wasn't. I had a hard time feeling a part of. And I got picked on a lot. And, you know, one day in school, some kid scared me out of my lunch money, and I told my dad about it. And he looked at me, and he goes, "That's your fault. You never let anybody take anything from you." He used to box. He started giving me boxing lessons. I was uncoordinated, got knocked down a lot. And all of a sudden, this happy home became kind of scary. And all of a sudden, you know, honesty became a liability. And I created this warped way of thinking where if I did something wrong, I thought I was doing something right. It's not the reason I drank, but when I got sober, it definitely was addressed, you know. My father, he would drink heavily on the weekends, have, you know, card games, refrigerator packed with beer, and he wouldn't drink during the week. And I thought he was afraid of my mother. I was wrong. Later I found out he just was afraid of disappointing her. He wouldn't drink. But all of a sudden he exhibited, he was afraid, things would bother him, he'd be angry. And what I know today, he was running dry. He was a dry drunk Monday through Friday. But on the weekends, he was the happiest guy on the planet. And as years progressed, he would say things that annoyed me. He'd be drunk like a pirate. Don't do like I do. Do like I tell you to do. And I thought that was the most annoying thing I ever heard in my life. And, you know, when I got to the eighth grade, I started to get rebellious. I was at St. Genevieve's, more Irish kids. And I said, why do I got to go to this church? Why do I got to go to this school? And my father gave me the answer that made sense. And it's a government's way to control people. And I'm thinking, oh, there is no God. You know, am I a sheep or am I a wolf? I was too little to be a wolf, so I didn't want to be a sheep either. So I wound up going to with my people to Pacoima Junior High. I didn't crease my jeans. I didn't have the walk. I didn't have the talk. And the first day there, some cholo goes, hey, how come you don't crease your jeans? And I answered him in Spanish, ¿qué te importa? And that means, what's it to you? And I paid a big price and got jumped for that remark. So I wasn't even accepted by my own people. And there's many times I ran home. And there's many times I had to fight whether I liked it or not. And there was this tunnel by Pacoima Junior High. It was Cago Canyon. On the other side of that tunnel were the future bikers of America, and they were smoking weed. I fell in love with marijuana. And I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but drugs are part of my story. And my first attempts at drinking with the neighborhood kids didn't go well either. For a lot of years, I thought my name was Ralph, because when the kids see me coming, they'd say, hey, here comes Ralph. And, you know, it's strange, you know. From Pacoima Junior High, I went to Poly. I got on the wrestling team. Before I went to Poly, I took judo at the Japanese American Center, and it helped me from cracking my head when my dad would knock me down. So when I got into wrestling in high school, I did fairly well. And for a couple of years, I did pretty good in 11th grade. And then we used to go to this little paisa bar, this little Mexican bar down the street on Lancashire called Speedy's. And as long as we had money, there was service. Funny how things work in the late 70s. And the world was my oyster. I was having a lot of fun. I would sneak out the window at night, go party, get chased the girls. Sometimes they'd give me a black eye, you know. And one night, and my dad would always catch me. He'd work at the swing shift from 3 till 11 at night. And every time I home, it was like 11:30, midnight, and he was there waiting for me. I'd get my butt kicked. One night when I came in, he didn't beat me up, but he gave me an ultimatum. Either go to college or get a job. My father had a third grade education, and he put my sisters through college, and he wanted to do that for me. But he had really strict requirements. I didn't dig it, man. And I just blurted out, I'm joining the Army. He called me a liar, but he didn't beat me up. Next day, I went down to the recruiting station, and they asked me, well, you got a high school diploma? Are you 18? I said, no. He goes, are you 17? You think your dad will sign you in? I said, I don't know. So first they tested me. I scored really high. The recruiter came over to the house, and my father was lost for words. He wouldn't sign for me to get a driver's license, but he had no problem signing me into the military. And he worked a couple more years and retired. And that summer he went to Mexico to visit his friends and relatives, and I partied. And August of 80, I got inducted into the Army. The first thing I noted when we're flying into Georgia is all the trees. I've never seen so many trees in all my life. And getting out of the plane, it was like 90 degrees, 120% humidity. It was rough. It was like being in a steam room. And all of a sudden, I learned to build these walls because I was afraid. See, before this time, I learned something from my father. It doesn't apply today. Life is pain. It has to be endured. You know what I know today in Alcoholics Anonymous? Life is only as painful as I allow it to be. If I don't want to rely on that God of my understanding, I deserve to feel everything that comes my way. I love being an alcoholic. These gifts, gratitude, you know, acceptance, mean everything to me today, because when I bump into those walls, I got to learn to go around them, not over them and through them anymore, you know. And when I got in there, I learned about the fear of failure. You know that in the morning, those movies show the drill instructor kicked the bucket to get everybody out of bed. That does happen. And I was always the last guy out. And then the next day I would get up by the light of the latrine and make my bunk and set up my AO, and I'd lay down. And when they kicked the can again, I was the first guy out the door. The fear of failure. I learned how to use fear to direct myself to do anything and go in any direction. But that's a painful way to live. You know, when we qualified with the M16s, they took us to a place called the White Barn. They were beer machines filled with old Milwaukee beer and Old English 800. They let us drink as much as we wanted. And they made us do run in circles, push-ups, puke our guts out. But all of a sudden, I felt part of something greater than myself, the military. You know, at this point, I didn't even have a clue about God. You know, and I celebrated my 18th birthday in a swamp in South Carolina. And all of a sudden, I wasn't lonely anymore. I wasn't homesick anymore. I felt good about myself. I became an arrogant little guy. The thing about the military for me, it made me grow an ego as big as a mountain. And I felt invincible, you know. And I came home on leave. Dad told me to be home at 10. I said, nah. I stayed at a friend's house. And I shipped out. And to this day, this is part of my pitch. I don't believe Mexicans belong in Germany that drink world's greatest beer, world's friendliest, craziest women. And I found out sex is also a drug. And I did everything I wanted to do. Once again, it was trade, you know. I was going to make a career out of the military. Then I saw these guys rolling the base in their own little cars. They had their place off post. They were selling hash, black marketing cigarettes. And I got involved in that. And I thought life was easy. I had a duality. One side, I was a good troop. They always wanted me to go to the field first up. I was a multi-channel communication equipment operator. We'd send microwave communication mountaintop to mountaintop, line of sight. And I always got picked to go out first because I always knew I'd get it done. And the alcoholic ego, pats on the back. I was an E4 at like 13 months in service, you know, and I really wanted to be a sergeant. But I didn't have enough time in service, and I had to re-enlist for it. I wasn't doing that. And in the process, when I got to be almost 19 years old, I crossed that invisible line from hard drinker to alcoholic. I had to drink every day. And I was selling hash, smoking hash. I was doing everything wrong. And when it came time for me to re-enlist, I chose to get out. And during that time, it was 1983, and there was a new product on the street called cocaine. And all the pretty girls were packing their nose with it. So the first time I tried it, I'm like, heart's racing. I'm thinking, what is this all about? I didn't like it. Tore my nose up. And then I started a little pool business. It took me like 3 years to get a big route. It went from 10 pools to 60 pools in a week. I was making decent money. And my favorite day was Wednesday. I'd start my route at the Hollywood sign on Beachwood. And I'm cleaning, you know, these millionaires' mansions and their jacuzzis. And I'd come down Beachwood to Franklin. I'd do commercial accounts. And then there was this one client behind the Whiskey Go-Go on Sunset Plaza Drive. He was a record producer on his way out of the business. And the first thing I noticed when I walked in his backyard, he was in a jacuzzi with a couple girls, and he was freebasing an outside issue. And he had good product, and next thing you know, I'm selling this to all my friends, thinking that I was giving them a good deal. And for a while, I was going to all the cool parties. Girls were everywhere, and once again, it was trade. And I went to concerts and limousines and thought I was living. I had the perfect front. Who would suspect Alex the Pool Man? Angel's Pools. That was the name of the business. I had accounts in Baldwin Hills. That's like the Black Beverly Hills. And it was real easy to find clients. As soon as I seen they were growing weed in their backyard, I knew how to approach them. If they're doing one thing, they're probably doing another. And I thought I was getting away with a lot. And then someone showed me towards the end of that year how to check the purity with baking soda. And everything changed within a week, a month. It was fast. I was renting houses. Then they went to apartments. And all of a sudden, I was giving my clients really bad service. So I had to get out of that service, and I had to sell the business. And one of my clients was a biker that ran a concrete pumping business in Shadow Hills, A1 Concrete Pumping. I could tell you this because the guy's dead, and that business no longer exists. And he wouldn't even give me a job. The guy's name was Crazy Larry Eckhart, and yes, he was. And he gave me a try, you know, and all of a sudden, my biggest goals and dreams for about 8 years was making it to 7-Eleven at 5:45 to grab that first 12-pack. And this is the crazy part. I hated smoking crack, but I couldn't stop. I didn't even think beer was alcohol. It was my medicine every morning. You know, I'd had to grab that big pack of vitamins with that horse pill and a 12-pack just to get my day started. Health conscious alcoholic addict. Go figure. And the relationship with my parents. Well, my mom was never afraid of anyone. She wasn't afraid of anyone or anything because she had a deep faith in her Catholic God. My father was disgusted, disappointed, and probably afraid of me. So when I would drop in on Christmas, it wasn't Christmas. It was a buffet. I'd get something to eat. load up a big glass of Presidente. Boom, the obsession to use drugs was kicking. I'd go straight to the phone and hook up with the connection. I became a creature of the night, Crackula. You know what I mean? I'd usually go to sleep when the sun came up unless I was working. And I was a thief. If I went to a job site and they wouldn't let me drink beer, they were going to miss some things. Skill saws, wrecking bars, shovels, hammers. But if you let me drink on your job site, your stuff was safe. I had simple requirements. 94 earthquake happened. I was on a job with a load of hot concrete. I had 300 feet of hose going down a hillside in Benedict Canyon doing V-ditches, and it kept going off. That means it was plugging up in the line. And I'm sitting here with a sledgehammer running up and down, beating this hose out. And I swear, if I wasn't young in those days, I probably would have had a heart attack. You know, and the intense work was probably somehow detoxing my body so I could get through it somehow. And the job started 11 in the morning. I was there 11 at night, and I couldn't move my arm. You know you hurt something when you can't wipe your butt the next morning. You know, and I went to the VA for treatment. They recommended I sue my workman's comp to get my arm worked on, and I couldn't do that job anymore. And for like 6 months, you know, I was out of that gig, and then I had to humble myself and move in with my folks for about a week. And they didn't want me, but they tolerated it. As soon as I got that first check, I was gone. And a friend of mine introduced me to driving tow trucks. And in those days, everybody was on something driving a tow truck. We had our tweakers, we had our crackheads, we had our potheads, we had our alcoholics. All that's cleaned up now. So don't get scared if you break down, the AAA guy shows up. And me and the night guy would do illegal tolls and steal from the company. We had dreams of buying Harleys, but we smoked a couple of them. And the boss called me in one day and said, we know that so-and-so and so-and-so is stealing. We know this because people call in asking for receipts to be reimbursed for insurance. And we know you're in on it. Come clean. And the only thing I knew about integrity was not ratting out my crime partners. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what they're doing. And they left me alone. And then one night I was drinking and using, and the sun came up, and I slept for a few hours. And when I woke up, I had a big obsession to use drugs. I had a renting a room, and at that time I had a bottle of schnapps on the dresser. I usually take a big hit on it in the morning to, you know, equalize the pressure in between my ears, and I didn't. My eyes were red. I didn't brush my teeth. I didn't take a shower. I got in my little car. At that time, it was an 85 Volkswagen Scirocco. The front hood was coat hangered shut because I had a tendency of blacking out and running into things. And at cigarette burnt interior, you know, it was a wonderful car. It smelled like cigarettes. And I was driving down in Parthenia off of Tobias. And what little hair I had was tingling. And I looked in my mirror and the cops were following me. And I go, not going to curse. Remember, foul language is not a sign of spiritual growth. And it was a female cop. I have been pulled over, snot-slinging drunk by men. And when a cop yells at you, they never arrest you. If I ever see you around, I'd always get away with it. But this time it was a little short cop, female cop, saw the bottle of schnapps tucked in my seat, looked at me, smelled me, saw my red eyes, and she got me out for a sobriety test. Passed the sobriety test. I wasn't even high. I was just tired. But she said, I got to take you down to Van Nuys Police Station. I said, no. You're going to impound my car. No. If you pass, I'll bring you back. So she cuffed me, and I'm laughing all the way down to Van Nuys. I got down to the Van Nuys Police Station and blew twice in that breathalyzer, 0.08. That is the lowest mark on the breathalyzer. And I sat there for 4 hours going, this is not happening to me. And they let me go. I took the bus, went back to my car, and I went and did what I had to do and got whatever I had to smoke. And a month later, went to court. And I got a knockdown to exhibition of speed. Bam. One more time, I got out of it. But he gave me strict requirements. If I got caught driving without a valid license, insurance, or registration, he goes, you might as well be drunk with two DUIs. Insurance, I never had insurance. So I had a weird moment of clarity, and I sold the car to the connection. When that went, all my stuff, all I had was a mattress and a clock radio. And for some weird reason, my sister dropped in on me, and I'm pretty sure that's a God shot. And she said, where's your car? Where's your stuff? And I had to get honest. I got a problem with drugs. I couldn't even admit to having a problem with alcohol. I did not want to admit beer was alcohol. I didn't think alcohol was a problem. It was the drugs. That evil demon, drugs. And she did the footwork and got me an outpatient at the VA Sepulveda. And I'd like to say that from that day forward, I was sober. I wasn't. That very first weekend, left to my own devices, I was smoking that garbage again, and I came up dirty that Monday. And they called me in a big team conference, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, the nurses, and they're all there, and I'm one guy in the corner, and I felt this big, and they asked me what my problem was. I can't live with myself anymore. So they gave me a 2.5 strikes the first week I was there, and they said, okay, if you start any problems with the people in the halfway house or anybody in the treatment, if you're ever late, we're going to throw you out. And the fear hit me loud and clear. And they got me involved with the Veterans Homeless Housing Project. I was homeless with a roof. And they sent me to this place in San Fernando called Casa Rivas. And the man that ran it, his name's Art Rivas. I didn't know this at the time, but he was dying of liver cancer. He had like 15 years of sobriety. And when I got there, he looked like Wolfman Jack with a Texas accent. How you doing? You know, and he always wore a suit or some cool pullovers. He had it going on. And I got in there and I had to learn to shut up, and it wasn't easy, you know. After a couple nights, my second night there, my head was coming apart. I would wake up every hour on the hour. Dudes are snoring and farting up the place, and I just couldn't sleep. And I'd get these dreams that used to terrify me. They were using dreams. I was getting high in the dream, and I'd wake up in the dream, and I'd be afraid. And I had to get honest, so I asked Art. I told him about the dreams, and he said the consensus of people that work in treatment and in the rooms is simply this. It's God's way of telling you not to go back there. And when he said that, it gave me a tenth of a second of relief. All of a sudden, that hole in my soul had a little bit of a fill, and it went away, and I started praying to that invisible man that I did not understand. You know, and I was raised a Catholic. I never felt that. And I understand why, because I was a young kid and I was running on a lot of selfish emotions, and that blocked me from the God that I did not understand. So it was a slow, painful journey. I had a lot of self-loathing. How could I let myself get here? I hated myself. If you're new and you're early in recovery and you're going through a lot of self-loathing, it's part of the first process, but catch it and start praying to the God that you might not understand. And at 6 months, the obsession to use drugs was lifted, and I felt it, and it was like a spiritual experience. I never thought that would end. Then I started doing the work. I met my first sponsor in anger management. Great place to meet your sponsor. He looked like a biker, but he didn't sound like a biker. He didn't use foul language. Little did I know, he had like 14, 15 years of sobriety. And he started working with me, and it took me 2.5 years to get that first inventory on paper. It wasn't because I was slow. I was damaged. I'd go to book study after book study, and I couldn't get it. My brain couldn't retain anything. I'd get bits and pieces, drops. And little by little, I started to gain a little bit more. Another day from that last drug got a little bit better, got a little bit brighter. And, you know, when I got that first inventory on paper, it was 2.5 years. And it was basically pain. The pain I put the people through and the pain that people put through me. But all of a sudden, something strange happened. The obsession to drink was lifted, and it was summertime. It was a beautiful feeling because I could walk out on a hot summer day and not crave a beer. I understood something. When I'm drunk, I make bad choices. No wonder I started using drugs. You know, during this time, I started rebuilding the relationship with my father. He started talking to me, but I still didn't dig what he had to say because he still was into pain and humiliation. My first Thanksgiving, first thing he said when he opened the door is, you're going to drink again. And I said something real foul. But he ignored me. When I walked in the house, there was no alcohol. That was weird. But my first Christmas, oh, there was booze all over the joint. But he tried. I got my job back at that company that didn't want me. I had like 5 driving points. I became a dispatcher. I hated that. Then all of a sudden, the owner was having an affair with the night guy. He wanted a Corvette. She wasn't giving it to him. He got fired. I became the night guy, and I took on commitments, noon meetings. I was a GSR. And during that time, I was really miserable, working 7 at night, 7 in the morning, 6 nights a week. So I looked in the mirror, And I blame myself for what I'm going through. So I, at 8 o'clock in the morning for a couple of weeks, I went to truck driving school. At that time, it was only $1,500. Took me a couple of weeks, but I got my commercial license. And when she found out about that, she put me to days. She didn't want to lose me. I wasn't stealing anything anymore. I haven't stole anything since I got sober. I don't borrow money from anybody since I got sober. I get annoyed when Bobby, if I'm short, he throws it on there and like, eh. Even Bobby, like $5 for like an hour bothers me because it reminds me of that old behavior. I used to be a bum. I don't want to go back to any of that at any time. And a lady sold the company. I went to another place and I was getting really miserable working around the clock driving tow trucks. I mean, it was great money, but there's no life. I mean, I stayed up for 72 hours going from one accident to another accident. It was miserable. So all my friends in the city kept telling me, go in the city, go in the city. So I started applying. I took test after test after test, and finally I got an interview, and it took me 4 years. But today I've been with the Department of Sanitation for almost 20 years. Everything good in my life is because I got sober. Around my fourth year, my father invited me to move back home. He's going to sell me his house. And after I moved back home, he had a heart attack, and I got him to Kaiser. Doctors gave him 6 months to live. They wanted to put a pacemaker and put him on dialysis. He got really calm. He said, nah, I'm good. He lived 9 months. And I watched this man that used to live in anger and fear become very calm and quiet. He took his fate with dignity and grace. And it was a powerful thing to witness. A lot of the gifts in these rooms, some are bitter and some are very sweet. And my big service with him is before I'd go to work, I'd go and get him his Mexican newspaper at L'Opinion so he'd have something to read when he was in the bathroom. And I share this all the time. A month before he passed away, he looked like the sucked up, brown, bald Kermit the Frog. And he goes, Alex. I said, what, Pop? And he looked at me, and he looked at my mom, and he goes, you and your mother. And I said, what? You're both fat. Thanks, Pop. Still cracking jokes a month before he passes away. That's courage. I will always share that because it means a lot to me to have been able to witness that. And when he passed away, it was November 9th of 2001, month after 9/11 almost. And I was going to meetings, but I stopped sharing. It was difficult enough for me to share about myself, let alone learning how to grieve for a man I hated. I hated my father, but towards the end of his life, I learned to love a man I hated. Another great gift. And when I got close to my fifth year, when I was supposed to take my cake for my fifth year, you know, we all see you get that first pop when your head comes out of your bottom end. Well, I popped it right back in and stopped going to meetings. I got this. I don't need you anymore. And I didn't thoroughly finish the steps. I was angry for the next 7.5 years for absolutely nothing. I was at work and my boss would tell me things like, why don't you try being nice? I don't have time, you know, and in that time, and from my year 5 to year 12, I'd have these agents from God, Joe Gomez. He'd be at the gym every day. I rented a room for him from 2 to 4. He wouldn't ask me about if I'm going to meetings. He would just be there. When I got into the city, I heard this magical voice. Oh, you're cured. I go, oh, it's you, an old timer with time on his way to retirement in the city. So everywhere I went, I would see AA people everywhere. It was just God reminding me where I belong. I failed in my relationship. I failed with my finances. And when I finally got in the city, I almost lost that job in my 8th year of sobriety, you know. And when I got to my 12th year, every part of my life was in pain. And there was a couple guys I wanted to hit. And I would have got arrested and terminated in that order, and I had to come back to these rooms. 2009, I came back to these rooms. I didn't know what was wrong. I was dealing with untreated alcoholism. I thought when you put the plug in the jug, life gets better. It does. But I didn't have any kind of control over my emotions, you know, because the ego grows wild and large in sobriety. And thank God for Joe Gomez. He got me through the steps. And I found out something about the first 3 steps. I'm getting right with God. 4, 5, 6, 7, I'm getting right with me. 8 and 9 are the payback. And 10, 11, 12 is daily maintenance. And this is funny. Step 6, we ask God to remove these defects of character. There's a sentence missing right now. takes time and practice to remove all these defects of character, and I'm still not perfect. I don't want to be perfect. That's a lot of work. The men I run with are not perfect, but I look at them and I accept them for who they are, what they mean to me, what we go, what we do. We're on an adventure in sobriety. We go to concerts. We go to conventions. We come to beautiful places like this. I see a lot of solid members in this room right now, and I wish you all the best, and I hope you stay sober. And during this journey, you know, it got bitter again. I mean, Joe Gomez made me his 10-minute pitch guy. The reason I'm able to speak to you tonight is Joe Gomez and Bobby. He keeps me sharp by plugging me into places I don't want to go. But I need to be here more today than I did 28 years ago. And, you know, today it's a beautiful gift. I own the home I grew up in. My sisters got their cut 14 years ago. 20th year in the city, you know. I write my own ticket. You know, the bosses I have started out with me. I don't want to promote. I'm 62 years old. I don't need a stroke at this point in time. I struggle with a lot of things, and this is how slow I really am. I read things years ago where, you know, to despise man is to despise God. There's a lot of people I don't like. I don't love everybody, but every year I stay here, I learn to like a few people. Every year I stay here, I learn to trust a few people, and if I'm really lucky, I learn to love a few of you, you know, and this ride in sobriety is a beautiful gift, and this is strange. The triangle came into my life a couple years ago. You know, I have to search out God every day, and I found out something really important about service, recovery, and unity. Every one of them is designed to search out God. Unity. I find God through a lot of people. Not everybody, but a lot. You know, in service, I've had a lot of commitments, you know, and we're doing God's work when we set up the meeting. We're the greeter at the door or the coffee man. That's doing God's work, you know, and recovery's the book. You know, right now, I used to have a lot of people. I used to be a body snatcher, you know. If you want to sponsor somebody and have a working knowledge of the 12 steps, raise your hand. I did that for about 10 years. A lot of them went out. Some of them stayed sober. The ones that stayed sober fired me, and I'm grateful because they get to work for someone else. And I'm sponsoring one man today, and 10 years ago, he had a family, a house, and he wanted to hold it together, but he decided to turn to alcohol, and he lost it all. And about a year ago, he came back to me 5 years dry, and he was ready. And I knew what being dry means. That means I was ready to find out what's really wrong. And he's been working with me steadily since last May, and he's having a phenomenal time with his wife, the second one. He's doing a great job. He gives me advice. And it's a beautiful gift. November 1st, 2014, me and Joe went out to Whittier. You know, we went and had some fish tacos. He loved fish tacos. And he was speaking at the Whittier group. Well, it was a meeting on Janine. And he couldn't walk around and interact with the people like he used to. He had to do his pitch sitting down. And he wasn't doing well. He's had a stroke recently. But he got on fire again and started carrying a pitch. And he talked to a room of alcoholics. A lot of them had time. And he said things to make them think, and he said things to make them laugh. And he was happy. And on the way home, we talked about things we were going to do, places we were going to be. I got to shake him goodnight. Next morning, my phone started burning. He had a heart attack after I dropped him off. He was in his little room watching TV, and he had a heart attack, and they found him there. And for about a week, I felt like I got hit with a bat. And I processed this, and at the end of the week, I realized what a gift to be with a man on his last day of earth doing what he loved to do the most, carrying the message to a room full of alcoholics. You know, I find gifts in negative things, and we turn negatives into positives in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll never forget that man. He meant a lot to me, and he got me to another place in sobriety. And Bobby went through his own hell, and when they were having a celebration of life in Port Hueneme, me and a friend went down there, and there was like 200 people in this room, and they were celebrating the loss of his daughter, Jessie. That's why I wear this monarch butterfly to honor him and his family. And He actually was able to pick my fat face out of this crowd of a couple hundred people, and it meant a lot to me. And my friend next to me goes, "That's God, Wink." And ever since then, he started out as my AA event coordinator. He plugged me into a lot of places. Matter of fact, he plugged me in here. And we've been trudging ever since. And when my mother passed away in 2014, I gave it to him, and he helped me get through that. Because every time I think about what he went through, it's nothing compared to my mom passing away. She was 90. It was her time. And what happened to his daughter, Jessie, wasn't fair. But I learned something about life even when I was loaded. There's a lot of things in life that's not fair. It's just life. Can I take the seemingly good with the seemingly bad? As long as I stay in these rooms, I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, this ride can be rough, but if we stay here and meet the right people to help us get through it, we can get through anything together. You know what I mean? How much time do I have?
4 minutes.
We're coming to the end of the ride, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want to leave you on a down note, so I'm going to give you a couple of moments of clarity with my mom and dad, and I hope no one gets offended. If you are, talk to your sponsors about it. One Christmas, my mom was wrapping gifts, and this woman never said she was sorry for anything. She never admitted to being wrong, and she never told me she loved me. You know, one day I came home from work, and she wasn't seeing good. She had a stroke, and her pupil wasn't focusing, and she was frying chicken, and she couldn't see that the flame was high, and she was getting spattered with hot oil. That was the last day she cooked. She didn't have to tell me she loved me. She showed me. One Christmas, she was wrapping gifts, and me and my sisters around there, just was a good feeling at Christmas, and she was wrapping gifts. I go, "Mom, you never said you loved me." She looked at me and kept wrapping. "Mom, you never admitted to being wrong." And she looked at me and kept on wrapping. "Mom, you never admitted to being sorry. You sorry you had me?" And she said, "Yes." I never want to forget that. First time she cracked a joke. And my father, before he passed away, we had a little talk, and he was telling me about his disappointments. And we got weepy over this. It was a weird spiritual conversation. He goes, "You know my daughters, Alex." I said, "What?" "You know, they went to college. They bought homes. They had children. They never gave me any problem." I said, "Yeah, I know." He goes, "But you were nothing but a problem." I said, "Yeah. I wish you were born a woman." And I said, "No. No." He said, "Why?" "I would have been a whore." I never want to forget that. I never want to forget that. You know, Mark, thank you for allowing me to come back out here. I wish you all the best. And you know, every year I come here, I learn to like a few of you. Every year I come out here, I learn to love a few of you. And maybe once in a while, we'll get to hang out and do cool things together. Thank you very much.